Explore the night skies with our large range of high-quality telescopes. Whether you're a novice or an astronomy expert, we have the right telescope for you in our Australian Geographic e-store. Explore the whole range and find the right telescope for you today. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/shop. Hi, I'm Chrissy Goldrick and this is Talking Australia, a podcast by Australian Geographic. Tim Jarvis is an environmental scientist, a polar explorer, mountaineer, filmmaker and successful author, as well as a sustainability expert. He was the first person to be awarded both Adventurer of the Year and Conservationist of the Year by the Australian Geographic Society, and he's a member of the Order of Australia. He's in demand as a public speaker and a leadership trainer, and he's an outspoken advocate of the urgent need to find practical solutions to climate change and other environmental problems. He's traversed icy wastes, survived freezing, perilous oceans and hot, dry deserts, and he's been described by the Australian Museum as an adventurer who never chooses the easy road. And I'm thrilled to welcome Tim Jarvis to Talking Australia. Hello, Tim.
Hi there, Chrissy. How are things?
Yeah, good. Good to see you again.
You too.
Now, Tim, you're known to us and to our readers, and you have been for many years as an adventurer, in particular a polar adventurer. We'll talk a little bit about that today. Always a fascinating topic for us and for our readers and our listeners. But we'll also talk about your role in advocating for climate change, for action on climate change. This is really how things have evolved for you. You're, you know, that mix of adventure and conservationist, and it's kind of going to be interesting to talk to you about, you know, how those two things fit together.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point. They sort of began as one, moved apart, and now well and truly back together again. It's a very, very good way of communicating climate change, is to use the adventures as a way to do that.
And you know, I think when you are sort of communicating quite sort of difficult concepts, there's some of the ways in which you can get the attention of people through those adventures, these great epic adventures, means that it makes getting the message across a little bit easier, I think, or you can engage people's attention better.
I think so. It's kind of a metaphor, isn't it? And people like storytelling. And sometimes if you're talking about a subject which can be perceived as being a bit threatening, like, you know, a business's impact on the climate, if you're talking using some other subject matter as the point of discussion, like an expedition, they can have that conversation that they know is about them, you know is about them, but you're both pretending it's about something else, and you can have a more frank discussion. So it does work very well.
Yeah. Now, you've witnessed the effects of climate change at both extremes of the planet, at the North and the South Polar regions. But interestingly, you've also witnessed it in the equatorial regions of the world, in fact, at latitude zero. Look, I'm not even sure that very many of us even knew that there were icy areas right in the middle of the planet along the equator. So tell us a little bit about some of the adventures that you've had there, and where are these mountains? Why are there icy places right in the hottest parts of the world?
Well, it's a very good point. You're right. I spend a lot of time in the polar regions, and I think most people anticipate that there is ice there, and that ice there is under threat by the effects of climate change, that we're probably responsible for it. So that bit is kind of reasonably easy for people to grasp, but it doesn't necessarily grab the attention of political leaders, the media, and the corporate world. You need some point of difference that makes people sit up and notice. And the penny dropped for me 5 or 6 years ago that you need an unlikely place where there is still glacial ice, where you can tell the story of the human impacts of climate change on it. And the place I went for was the equator, where you have these 25 mountains that have a glacier. And, you know, the media immediately sit up and go, "What do you mean there's a glacier at the equator? You know, whereabouts?" Mm-hmm. And you've got them hooked. Once you've got that initial door-opening moment, you can then have a discussion about what the likely plight of those glaciers is, what it means for local people, and you've got numerous stories to tell in a place which is very, very heavily populated by people often who don't have the capacity to react to the change that's coming. Whereas if you pick the Arctic and the Antarctic, the Arctic, yes, you've got indigenous people for sure, but they're often very well adapted to the climate in which they operate. Antarctica has no people apart from scientists and tourists who go there for brief periods of time. But the equator really unlocks things for people, you know, and you talk about ice in the Ruwenzori Mountains of Uganda, and then you talk about the fact that ice is disappearing very, very quickly and come out with stories of people who've been impacted, and it's a very powerful, powerful combination.
So in some ways, people were finding out there was ice there at the same time they found out that the ice was endangered and probably wouldn't be there in 20 years' time.
That's right.
It's a really shocking kind of concept to try and absorb, really, isn't it?
It is shocking. And, you know, the byline of the project is, you know, we won't save these glaciers. What else are we prepared to lose? Because the ice is disappearing so quickly that, with the exception of one or two of the highest mountains, maybe the tip of Kilimanjaro, Chimborazo in Ecuador, the top of Cotopaxi in Ecuador, they may retain a little bit of their ice just purely because they're very, very high. Chimborazo is 6,370 metres, so very, very high. But the rest, unfortunately, that ice is doomed, and the project allows you to tell the story of the decline of that ice and for people to witness it for themselves in kind of real time, because this lot's disappearing in the next 15 to 20 years. And you can document it, and you can instill a sense of urgency where it might have been lacking.
And I guess that's the thing. It's visual, isn't it? I mean, because, I mean, when we try and visualise climate change, it's quite difficult to do. But you've got comparative photographs of some of these glaciers. I think Mount Stanley is one of them, where there were, as a photograph from about 1910.
Yeah.
It's very impactful when you can actually see it with your own eyes in that way.
You know, it's absolutely right. I mean, I challenge anybody to see 405 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. It's not a visual thing. And yet we as humans are driven by what we can see. You know, seeing is after all believing. And if you can attribute the changes you're seeing to these glaciers to us, then the change is very easy to see. We've got historical photographs. You can compare it. Mount Stanley is the largest ice cap in Africa, in fact, bigger than all the others put together, and that is declining extremely quickly. It's really powerful.
Now, you got your idea about visiting these equatorial glaciers when you were on South Georgia, and what you saw there was because you were recreating Shackleton's traverse of South Georgia at the end of his survival trip from Elephant Island. We will talk about that in a little while. But you got your idea when you were really down in those Antarctic regions, and it's really for your polar adventures in the southern part of the world that we got to know you in the first place. So can we sort of go back to some how all that came about and talk about some of those early adventures of yours? In 1999, I think, which is when we sort of first found out about you or got to know you, you manhauled a sled all the way to the geographic South Pole. So tell us about that adventure. Was that your first sort of venture into these sort of parts of these regions of the world, and why the South Pole, and you know, what effect did that have on you? Because it sort of changed or altered the course of your life to the one that you're on now, really, didn't it?
It really did. Look, I'd come from the old mother country originally and come here to work as a scientist in Australia, and I'd done a couple of Arctic trips prior to that, Spitsbergen and up in Arctic Norway, but had never been to the Antarctic, and in fact moved to Adelaide to work as a scientist, and Adelaide is the home of Douglas Mawson. That, you know, even though you wouldn't think of it as a sort of Antarctic place, John Reimel is from there, Douglas Mawson is from there, Hubert Wilkins is from there, and so sort of three out of the four, if you think of, Hurley as being the fourth in that kind of group of famous pioneers of Antarctic exploration from Australia, you know, three of them are from Adelaide. So I found, you know, that Antarctica was drawing me in, and made a bid to cross the place on foot, unsupported, got to South Geographic Pole in what was then a sort of record time, I guess. But it wasn't about records, it was about getting there quickly to make sure the food lasted for a bid to cross the whole thing, which ultimately wasn't successful. Food became contaminated, but that then sort of set the scene for other opportunities, and somebody had suggested I might try and defend Mawson's honour. Mawson had been accused by some of needing to cannibalise the second man who died in his arms on an expedition that had gone wrong. And guess what? I'm the same size as Mawson. And someone said, well, why don't you do it with the food that he said he had without the need to eat? In my case, the increasingly nervous Russian guy who, with whom I travelled, who was the kind of the fall guy, he was extracted at the same, you know, point in the expedition that the original guy died for Mawson. Mawson trudged on and made it, and so did I. But it was took a fairly brutal toll on the body and the mind. And I like to feel that we proved Mawson's innocence, and that then led to the Shackleton expedition, where someone's saying, well, you've done something wearing period clothes, suffering, why don't you try another of those? So back down I went to attempt Shackleton's journey.
Now, when this idea of the historically accurate kind of recreations of these things probably sounded good when you were sitting, maybe planning it at home, but tell us about what that actually means for someone who's down there in these really unforgiving places.
Well, that's right. Look, there's no point trying to, shed light on what happened on Mawson's original trip if you're wearing Gore-Tex with a sat phone and, you know, doing things differently. You've got to don the woolens and the leather boots and the cotton smocks and eat the pemmican, which is essentially sort of lard. You've got to traditionally navigate. You've got to pull a wooden sled. It's got to be the same weight. You've got to really suffer as they do, inhaling the kerosene fumes off your Primus stove and really doing it the way they did. Otherwise, the experiment is invalid. And I tell you what, there are many, many things that are difficult and challenging about those trips. One of the biggest ones is the fact that you, as a modern person, know that all the technology that we've developed in the 100 years since those original trips exists, but you've chosen to deprive yourself of using it. And that is psychologically really difficult when times are tough, you're frostbitten, malnourished, hungry, a bit depressed, on your own, trying to keep yourself going mentally, and you realize that you've just made these things infinitely more difficult for yourself by just depriving yourself. And so the Mawson trip was very tough. With Shackleton, it involved rebuilding the boat, learning to traditionally navigate, wearing the same old clothes, eating the same food, and out on the Southern Ocean in a big storm.
You were questioning it. But this time you weren't alone. So let's just roll back to the Mawson one. So Mawson's, survival trip is one of the great survival trips or experiences of all time. But it's not as well known as Shackleton. And was that also part of why you did it? Because of for his reputation? I mean, I know you were trying to prove that he didn't eat Mertz or whoever it was. It was Mertz that was left, wasn't it, after Ninnis down the crevasse. But also, you know, is it partly because of to raise the profile of Mawson because really what he did alone. I mean, really quite an incredible achievement, and then was still stuck in Commonwealth Bay for another year even after he got back after that survival journey of 500 miles or whatever it was that he walked.
Yeah, look. Had Mawson been a Brit or a Norwegian or an American, I think it's fair to say that he probably would have had more recognition, particularly in those countries. And you know, having moved to Adelaide, I mean, I was absolutely amazed that his story was not more well known. I remember the old balaclava-clad face of Mawson's on stamps I used to collect when I was a small kid growing up in Asia. I remember thinking, "Oh, who is this guy?" So I had a vague notion of who he was, but I was amazed that his incredible journey of survival just hadn't been told. So it was definitely an element of wanting to redress the balance. And his descendants, who are the McEwans and the Thomases, he had two daughters, and obviously they, you know, at the time they assumed their husband's name. So the Mawson name is kind of gone, but the relatives live on, and they were very modest, upstanding people, with whom I enjoyed a really good relationship. And I really wanted to just defend Mawson's honour and shed some light on an incredible expedition, not really do the cannibalism thing. Mm. That was really almost a kind of media construct.
Yeah.
And I had to run with it. Mm-hmm. But they were very happy with the way it all panned out. And I like to think we got his name out there in lights like he deserves. So.
Yeah, very good. And so that led you to the invitation from a descendant of Shackleton to do another one of these historic. Was there a bit of your sort of heart that sank at the idea of doing it again and getting lashed wearing those that clothing that really doesn't protect you at all, or not enough? Or were you excited about it?
Just as an aside, I went to see a broadcaster a couple of years ago and was pitching an idea for an environmental sort of show, if you like. And they said, aren't you the guy who always suffers wearing the old gear? So I'm well and truly sort of typecast in the sort of B-movie role. But the I'd done Mawson and I'd got to know Alexandra Shackleton, who's Sir Ernest's granddaughter. And she's sort of the keeper of the flame for Shackleton. She manages the whole Shackleton estate and defends his honour and all that sort of stuff. And I'd met her in 2000 in London at an event. And so I'd got to know her, and she had been sort of hinting strongly that, knowing I was planning the Mawson expedition in the mid-2000s, that, you know, if it went well, why not look at her grandfather's trip? So as soon as I finished the Mawson trip in 2006, the first call I got from her was one congratulating me and then saying, well, how about it, you know?
Yeah. So.
And I was honoured to be asked.
Yeah. And so that sort of took up the next few years of your life, planning that trip, because you had to recreate the boat. I mean, the story of Shackleton is very well known. We're not going to go through it again here, but I suppose suffice to say that it wasn't trekking across the icy wastes. It was actually going to be a boat trip that you took from Elephant Island to South Georgia, and then followed by a traverse of South Georgia over the top of that island, which can be, on a good day, a very pleasant place, and on a bad day, a place you really don't want to be. So there was some sort of more sort of technical aspects, I suppose, of building a replica boat and getting a crew together, and also then, you know, you've got all the sort of I suppose the logistical things of making a movie about it. So, you know, that always goes along with these adventures, is the story that you need to tell afterwards. So tell us a little bit about how all that came together, and were you you were expedition leader on that?
That's right. And I'd been asked, I said yes. I think it's fair to say that Shackleton's granddaughter, who's still a very dear friend, is not a person to whom you say no. When she said, will you, she really meant you will. It was a sort of rhetorical question. But you're right, it took many years to plan it. And one of the things that really excited me about it, apart from the fact that it's you know, according to Edmund Hillary, the greatest survival journey of all time, was the fact that for me as a person, it was a totally different exercise. I mean, I guess I'd become something of a, you know, if there is an area of expertise, I've got pulling heavy objects over ice caps. Mm. And this wasn't about that. Mm. This is about constructing a replica boat and escaping from the Antarctic, followed by mountaineering. So it didn't really play to my strengths, second bit a bit more than the first, but I was probably the worst sailor on the boat in the end. And it was just a fascinating exercise, remaking everything, learning to traditionally navigate with a sextant on a pitching boat, wearing non-waterproof clothes, designed for a crossing of the driest, windiest continent, not an open boat trip. And you know, even in the most miserable points, it was fascinating to me, the whole exercise.
And you weren't alone. So this was you were actually leading a group. And so were there sort of moments in that you were thinking about men like Douglas Mawson and Ernest Shackleton, and about the sort of, I suppose, the nature of leading a group of people, about the nature of leadership itself, and what set these, particularly these two men, apart and allowed them to achieve and survive, really, and also for other people to survive as a result of their sort of leadership qualities? Was that something that you probably didn't have much time to reflect on it, I'm sure, during, but was it something that you thought about?
Yeah, you don't find yourself asking that question, what was the difference between them and one another and me, and how am I going to do this? But it definitely was a totally different challenge for me. I mean, for a start, you've got a very high caliber team of people to do this thing, and you've got to try and retain your credibility in the eyes of those people in some of the most challenging conditions, you know. So it puts a totally different pressure on you that, you know, focusing on a solo trip where you're pulling a sled, it's just down to you. You don't have to convince anybody else. You just got to motivate yourself. So a totally different thing. In terms of Mawson and Shackleton, I mean, Mawson was a determined, steely individual, probably you know, by all accounts from the period, not the best man manager. He just set a positive example of what he expected of people and got on with it himself. And you were expected to sort of keep up. That was, you know, the way that many have perceived him. Shackleton was really the opposite. He was a man manager, people person, had emotional intelligence, as we now call it, where he understood his own strengths and weaknesses, but was really intent on getting the best out of people, brought everyone along with him, and in a crisis was the kind of person you wanted by your side. And I guess, you know, both of their techniques, I suppose, ultimately worked. Mawson driven, pulling others along with him, because, of course, the one where he lost both his colleagues was not the only thing he did. He did three other very successful expeditions. Shackleton didn't ultimately achieve the goals he set out to achieve, South Geographic Pole, of course, crossing Antarctica, but he did bring everybody home, for which he's now renowned.
That's right. It was a magnificent failure or something like that, as they call it.
I don't think he really understood how impactful it would be long term, because of course everyone's now heard of Shackleton because of the fact that he brought everybody home and he pursued the saving everyone with the same conviction as the original goal of crossing Antarctica, which was obviously immediately no longer possible with the loss of the ship. Yeah, it's legendary stuff.
Yeah.
And made a lot of personal sacrifices to ensure everyone else made it.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah. And of course, didn't really live much longer himself after that. He was...
No, that's right. I mean, he... many people don't realise that, you know, 6 years later and he was dead, buried back at South Georgia, which was the scene of his greatest victory. You know, he died of a heart attack. Yeah. Undoubtedly much of that to do with the, you know, self-imposed stresses of taking on all the responsibility for the survival of 27 men, as it was on the Endurance trip.
We will be back with our conversation after a quick break.
Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's three issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Plus, you will also receive exclusive benefits, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia.
I suppose both of those expeditions, the Mawson recreation, the Shackleton, what difference, I mean, what was the effect of achieving those goals yourself on your life and the direction that you took after that? Because obviously, I was saying before, you were on South Georgia, you saw those receding glaciers there, and in fact the disappearance of one completely, I think, only left now a glacial lake in its place, and you saw the speed with which that was happening. So that was another one of these very sort of clear visual indicators of what was happening with the warming of the planet. So tell me about your own personal journey after finishing those to where you are today.
Well, Mawson led immediately on to Shackleton. So no sooner had I drawn breath and got through that, and a book was made and a film was made, and you come out of the back end of that, and I went straight into pretty much planning the Shackleton journey. And I think you're right. I mean, I think there were two dawning realizations that, you know, I think it's fair to say when you know, reach the summit of a mountain or you cross an ice cap and you finish and you go home and you sit down, you don't immediately have this epiphany with every single experience you've ever had just kind of appearing clearly in front of you. It takes many years for the repercussions of all the stuff you've done to really sort of hit home. And it was definitely with the case with Shackleton. I mean, I really felt that a lot of the leadership he showed and some of the key take-homes as to how that unfolded are ones that you could repurpose and use to apply to some of these global issues we're currently faced with, like in climate change and loss of biodiversity. And so that was the first realization. The second thing was the sheer amount of documentary evidence that you had showing the change between their trips in the heroic era 100 years ago and the situation now. And like you say, with South Georgia, crossing that island, our trip was not the same as Shackleton's. I mean, the third glacier that he crossed, which was this body of ice called the Koenig, is now this a lake. And that's a very powerful thing to experience. You think, wow, for him it was a physical barrier to get to the whaling station to cross this thing. For us it was a wade, a wade across the thigh deep, you know, waist deep lake, and that mighty piece of ice is vanished. So it's those two things, it's the leadership lessons and the before and after that that you can really use to good effect in the climate piece. And I think it's fair to say I have been ever since.
And you timed the 25-0 project to coincide with the Paris climate talks in December 2015. So I guess, you know, what that brings sort of really to that that crossover between adventure and conservation. What role do you think adventure and exploration can play in the communicating of environmental issues?
Well, there are many, many ways to do it. I mean, I think for a start, it's a very good visual way of showing change, because you go to Antarctica or the Arctic or the glaciers at the equator that have, you know, dwindling glaciers, those mountains, and, you know, you can visually show what's going on. And if you can attribute the changes you're seeing to us, then it's powerful, because seeing, as I say, is really believing. In terms of the leadership stuff, you know, the parallels between the expedition experience and what we're now going through, you know, whether it's trying to motivate a team of people to achieve a goal in an expedition context, which is all about understanding everyone's different and their motivations are a bit different, that's a directly transferable bit of information to, say, the climate dialogue, where you're looking at trying to persuade a bunch of countries to pull as one to achieve a climate outcome, breaking the enormity of the challenge down into manageable pieces, which is a routine sort of expedition thing, is something that we need to do with a with an issue like climate. You know, everyone has their role to play. You have to celebrate successes along the way, but the road is long and you need to break it down and keep everybody there with you for the journey. So, look, there are many, many examples of that kind of thing that I've sort of brought into the 25-0 project particularly, where I focus a lot of the time on, yes, you've got the visual change, but I also look at the lessons that I've learned from all these years of expeditioning that I think can be applied to those things. And it proved to be very effective at COP21 in Paris. We beamed in from the summit of Mount Stanley in the ruins Ori and said, look at this, you know, look at the change. What are we going to do? And it really got cut through in an otherwise very jaded, busy, noisy space. And we had a press conference there that was supported by governments, and the message was seen by everybody.
And in terms of how you say, you know, dealing with these what can be really overwhelming problems by breaking them down into things that I suppose in smaller pieces that you can tackle, in some ways you've done that yourself personally, haven't you? Tell us about your latest project, which is the Fork Tree Project. This is where you yourself are basically rolling up your sleeves and really getting down to do something very practical about biodiversity and climate change.
That's right. I mean, I've always been a very practical person anyway, but I think it's important to, you know, walk the talk. You know, I don't think anybody wants to hear you lecturing them about the way they should be living their lives if you're not prepared to stand up and do it yourself. And another role of really good expedition leadership is, or leadership more generally, is you don't ask someone to do something you're not prepared to do. And sometimes the best way to lead is to show a positive example, and Fork Tree is really that, or at least I hope it is. It's reforesting an old, very, very run-down pastoral property that's had 160, 170 years of misuse, overgrazing by cattle and sheep, and all the remnant vegetation pretty much destroyed. And I've decided to rebuild it the way it used to be. And it's amazing how many people in the corporate and political world see you're doing something tangible like that, and they're more prepared to listen to some of your more strategic advice because you're someone who's actually crunched the numbers and pulled your sleeves up and started planting trees. And they think, well, there's a lot of stuff behind the scenes you must have had to do to get to the point where you're doing the physical stuff. We're prepared to listen to how you're project managing this dream into reality. And And it's been an uplifting experience.
So tell us a little bit more about it. So for someone like yourself, you're now actually, driving a tractor? I mean, what does it look like? How do you go about it? I mean, do you get overwhelmed when you look at it and you think, wow, this is, what have I done? What have I taken on?
Look, it can easily be like that. And you do definitely find yourself taking leaves out of the expedition leadership notebook. You think, okay, break the enormity down, celebrate success, focus on the things you can control. And you find yourself doing that. And when you're faced with a sea of destruction, and you've got, olives and thistles and Salvation Jane in the form of introduced stuff, you've got very little kind of wildlife apart from birds, you've got pines, but not much in the way of she oaks or gums. I've got rubble from many, many years of dumping of demolition waste on a bit of the site by the guy who owned it prior to me. And you've just got to focus on individual bits of the jigsaw and remain focused, not allow yourself to get distracted, because it's very easy to start off, in the morning doing one thing and then seeing something else and think, I'll just do that for 5 minutes. And next thing you're doing some kind of non-essential thing. And so you focus on getting individual bits done and ticking them off. And I'm kind of a list maker, always have been,
Excellent.
My lists would
Love
say,
list
you know,
maker.
Organize sock drawer, solve global poverty. You know, they're two things for the day. Well, at least I can get one of them done and then we'll think about the other one, and you build momentum and so on and so on. So.
And did you have to, so it's in South Australia, this area?
Yeah, it's in the Fleuria Peninsula, which is a fantastic place. It's got pretty good rainfall for SA, which is very dry. In fact, it's got just about the best rainfall in the state down there, and it's got good soil. And it's near to Adelaide, relatively, about an hour away. A lot of eyes on it, that's what you want. And you've got a lot of dairy farming, cattle grazing and sheep. And arguably we need a bit less of that, a bit more of the natural stuff. So you've got the right kind of target audience seeing the work you're doing. And that's important too.
And does that mean including sort of the landowners around? What are they, show an interest? Do they sort of basically look over the fence and go, what are you doing? Or, to that extent or not?
You get mixed messages. I'd say the majority of people have been very supportive. One or two are a bit, ask questions like, where are your fire breaks? Are you putting fire breaks in between all these trees? And, the trees can lead to fire. And I say, yeah, but I mean, lack of trees would be far worse than trees with a slightly increased risk of fire. Yes, I've got them. And, I think once you start to engage with people, they listen. When they can see you're out there toiling away, doing the hard yards yourself, and they can see you've got a bit of thinking has gone into what you're doing, and they can see some of the benefits even for their livestock, frankly, while the livestock are still there. They get more shade, shelter from the wind. Actually, it improves productivity in the dairy herds near my place, the fact that I've got trees on my land once they're grown. So you sell to people based on what you think they will want to hear to try and garner their interest and get their respect. And again, it's a bit Shackleton, You pitch the message according to the person who, to the audience, speak their language. And I think I'm winning people's trust.
So it sounds like a very long term. And when you talk about planting trees and trees growing, trees don't grow in 5 minutes. So you're in it for the long term. What kind of long-term strategy, you thinking 20 years or more? Or
it won't take 20 to plant everything. I did 3,800 this winter, and the parcel of land I've got can take about 25,000. I've got 4,000 slated to put in this winter coming. I haven't thought about year three yet, because it's dependent on what sort of summer we get, how well the stuff I've planted already takes. If the blue gums and the pink gums and the she oaks, which are obviously all trees, take, and by year three they might start to provide a bit of shade, you can start to put in some middle story, grasses and things like that, which if you put them in now would just be outcompeted by all the introduced grasses. So you've got to create some shade with trees as the upper story. 2 or 3 years down the line, we'll look at how well they're going and then think about what to put in next. If that still hasn't sort of killed off the introduced grasses, you maybe put in a few more trees and and wait.
And does your family get involved? Do your friends come over, and do you get help with it, or is it a sort of?
Yes, look, I've had a lot of help from some what you might think as being unlikely quarters. So AIA Health Insurance, for example, they are worried about climate change impacts on health. So they're very interested in helping with tree planting because they can see there's benefits there, apart from it being the right thing to do. The property sector, quite a number of organisations have said, look, we know we've got a big carbon footprint, can we buy some trees?
Yeah, so it's like carbon offsetting.
It is. You look. Yeah, look, I've got a simple methodology. It's not accredited. A lot of these organisations have supported me and physically come down there and seen what we're doing and love what's being done. They know I don't get paid. Nobody does who works there apart from, a couple of tradies doing things like, a bit of fencing with me. No salaries to support, just goes into the raw costs of making the place good again, really. And that's brought a lot of respect. So, yeah, they are carbon offsets, but they're carbon offsets based on me working out what the organization's carbon footprint is and then telling them how many trees they'd need to do it. And look, the beauty of this whole project is you can just repeat it and scale it because I'm looking at how we now measure how much carbon a block of land sucks out of the atmosphere more simply, how we can do that more simply than the current arrangement, which is very complicated and puts off farmers from following suit because it's too costly and too time consuming. So it's not just what I'm doing, it's about how you can repeat this elsewhere.
And you're also creating habitat for native species as well, so the offsetting biodiversity loss.
That's right. And look, we've got some really good bird life there. We've got some cockatoos, we've got lorikeets, we've got galahs, we've got, some hawks. We've got some really nice bird life returning. And of course, they're seed distributors and, they're the first ones to come back. Once you've got them, you can start to encourage other things. But the first cab off the ranks, definitely the vegetation.
Well, it sounds like an ambitious project, but I think you've never shied away from anything like that in your life. And but it also sounds like a nice place to spend your time as well.
It's wonderful.
We know that the great benefits of spending time out in the great outdoors and out in nature as well.
I'll be there on Friday and I can't wait. You every weed you pull out, you think that's another introduced thing that shouldn't be here, that's not here anymore, and it'll allow something native to take its place. And you may well have a lot of problems happening in the world today, but not on your patch. And that's very satisfying. And others can follow suit. As I say, there's many ways to get involved.
Well, I wish you well with it, Tim Jarvis.
Thank you. Thanks, Chris.
And thank you very much for coming in and sharing your adventures and your hopes for the planet with us today on Talking Australia.
Really enjoyed it.
Thank you. That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia. If you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com. Or find us on Instagram, @Australian Geographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find special offers for our listeners, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait and go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from, so you never miss an episode. Thanks for listening. Until next time.